Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Tuesday, the 12th of May, 2020. On the podcast today, I have Vadim Alexander, head of healthcare at SP Angel. And Vadim covers a couple of COVID stocks, but the main one is Beximco Pharmaceuticals, BXP. He also talks about Novacyt. But BXP is a very interesting one. It produces generic drugs, and one of those in the pipeline is remdesivir, which, of course, massive upside. And it's worth looking at the company. It's very interesting. You can't buy it through normal stockbrokers, though. It's a US stock, but it has AIM listing. But it's a bit complex, but worth looking into. Very interesting anyway. Also on the podcast, Glenn Goodman, former ITV News business correspondent and now the author of The Crypto Trader, covers this week's Bitcoin, blockchain, cryptocurrency news. Also chats about negative interest rates and the effect it'll have maybe on gold. Talk about the halving, of course, Bitcoin halving as well. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see both these lists, top 10 versions of these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you can also see our COVID index, our COVID-19 index, and that's where companies will trade strongly or could trade strongly, you know, due to this coronavirus, well-placed, and maybe even benefit from what's happening at the moment. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Want to keep up to date with all the companies in your portfolio? On the free Vox Markets app, you can create multiple watch lists and get instant news alerts about any company you follow. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Vadim Alexander, head of healthcare at SP Angel. You're Vadim.
Yeah, good, Justin. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Do you know what I mean? Look at those. It's funny. There's the air, the wind, the hot air seems to have come out of the COVID-19 stocks for a while. I mean, they've rallied tremendously. You know, the Novacyt and all that, and the Amiga Diagnostics and all these companies. I mean, it reminds me a bit. I spoke to somebody else about this. It reminds me a bit of the dot-com days when we had that bust there and bubble. Because you've seen a lot of companies now. Now, you know, people like Novacyt, they are genuinely doing, you know, a full-on proper quality test by the looks of it. But there's a lot of companies on the small end just attaching COVID-19. You know, they're almost trying to pivot as much as they can towards that, realizing there's a rush of hot money in that sector. So they're trying to get in the way of the wave, you know, and try to ride the wave a little bit. And so it's up to investors, isn't it, to really dig through and realize, you know, which company has something unique and which doesn't? Because when you think of it, most of these small companies are competing with the likes of Roche and people like that who can really churn out these testing machines, can't they, you know?
Yeah. No, you're right. Look, it is true. One has to separate the wheat from the chaff. It's difficult to do so on a quick timeline because a lot of companies are making announcements one after another, and they're highly technical. And some, in our opinion, are, you know, more directly involved in in addressing the COVID problem from either a diagnostic side or a therapeutic side, and others are far more earlier stage in development, and you know, things are changing on a weekly basis, as we know. You know, competing technologies, one, you know, might be better than the other. It's it is a fast moving market. I agree.
Yeah, but you're right. That's why I haven't even invested in any of those companies in directly involved in COVID. I do hold a few shares in Polarian, but that's because I've had longer time to research it. I like the potential there, and I can see what it's all about. But with these COVID stocks, I don't know what they're earning. Like I said, last time you came on, we sort of had a guesstimate sort of the margins and the prices, but we don't know, do we? Yeah. We haven't seen any of their financial statements or what they're earning at all. So it's really a punt, isn't it? A lot of these companies, you know, at the moment.
Some more than others. And I think that maybe I'll touch on a couple today. Well, we talked about Novacyt last time, so I won't go too long on that. But the difference between, say, a company like Novacyt that is getting revenues coming through, and they're substantially higher than historically the company, you know, 10 times higher than the company has done, it is a substantial amount of revenues that are coming through. That's more tangible, and you're right. We'll get the results come out, and we'll get more visibility, and that will come in time. But the company has made announcements describing the size of the revenues of the orders they've received or are completing. So and it's in the last announcement that they said something like 90 million sterling. So it's a significant amount of revenues coming in, and you can see by the ramp up of their production what they're aiming for, with 8 million tests a month. That's a significant number if you calculate at $5 to $10 a test and at 60 to 80% gross margin. So that we discussed last week, that is far further than other diagnostics players that are earlier stage, still developing tests. And that's the difference. I think that's important to recognize those differences, right. And picking out the winners, or at least I'm not to put down the ones developing tests. It's just to say there's more risk in ones that are in development versus ones that are clearly making revenues right now on the back of putting out their tests. But other companies, I'll give you another example of a company. More recently, there was this company, Beximco Pharma. Okay, this is a generic drug manufacturer. They're based out of Bangladesh. Many generic drug companies are based in India or now growing more so in Bangladesh because it's an even lower cost base with a similar highly educated workforce. So India used to be the champion, India and China, and now pricing pressure is moving outside of those countries and countries around them, Bangladesh being, I think, one of the more recent beneficiaries of that. Beximco Pharma is a good example of a company that churns out, good revenues, good margins, and, in a pretty stable market. These are drugs that are, have come off patent and are being sold at a lower price, but they can go much bigger mass market as a result. Countries like Bangladesh, for example, need drugs that are generic drugs because they can afford them. but Beximco, anyways, more recently, there was a New York Times report that was released on Beximco starting to produce remdesivir, which is one of these drugs that had emergency. In fact, the only one that's had emergency use approval from the FDA for the treatment of COVID. So this is the big winner drug. Bangladesh is has effectively the right to produce this drug from a generic standpoint. The company has announced that they're going to start producing it. So it's a bit of news that's kind of been lost to the market, I think. But we're talking about winners and losers, or stocks that have, here's a good example of a company that's going to produce a drug that will be in high demand and has been, has received approval by the FDA for emergency use currently. In fact, the only one. So it's exciting. And that's a good example of trying to pick out the bits of information out of this COVID. You're absolutely right. All these COVID stories that are coming out, here's one that's actually quite tangible. The company produces revenues.
And profit.
They have the capability, so they're
profitable already. So I didn't realize. Yeah. So for most people, if they want to gain access or exposure to remdesivir, which is, of course, this antiviral that's showing promise, they'd have to buy into Gilead Sciences in the US. But it's risen quite substantially anyway, I suppose, I think. But so I didn't realize. So Beximco actually produce it, do they, for them?
Well, so this is it. That's the, like so many things, there's so much news flow in this space right now that you want exposure to remdesivir, the only effective drug drug currently, or the one that's, sorry, I'm losing my voice here, the only effective drug currently, you know, there will be demand for this drug. Beximco has stepped up and are now, you know, they have the capability to produce it, and they've said to the New York Times, at least, that they're going to produce it. So that's very encouraging, and that's tangible. You know, they're not developing a new drug that whether we know works or not. They're using their skill set, which is they know how to manufacture generic drugs, and they've done so for hundreds of products. And they're a versatile company. And this is a further demonstration of that. So you know, this is a company that produces revenues, you know, substantial revenues, has made many, many drugs in the past, is fully regulated across the board in many jurisdictions. So to sell to their FDA compliant as well, their manufacturing facility, you know, just to give you an idea of the scale of their capabilities. This is a company that can deliver and has said so, and is right in the middle of this. It's a very hot area. You know, obviously producing remdesivir is something substantial.
Yeah, do you know what? I'm just looking at the results for the half year. So they did up 12.5% net sales. So this is half year, mind, and they're valued just the market. We just checked their market caps. But what's BX? Let me just check. It was 117, I think. It was sort of, I think, 172 million the market cap. But this is half year. 112.6 million pounds in revenue. Now profit after tax increased 16%. To 15.6, so you can double that pretty much. So 30 for the full year. Put on a P/E of 10, it's worth 300, and yet, so you can see they're pretty undervalued, aren't they? Really?
I mean, they are. So look, you know, you also have to factor in. We imagine that you know COVID's going to cause some. Look, this is just me speaking. I mean, it makes sense that COVID has affected global supply chains, and there's issues. You know what I mean? Globally, as a result of COVID. But they are in the right place, and I think the share price is moving accordingly. You know what I mean? This is a good example of how, you know, if you can produce remdesivir and you're allowed to, which they are, it's very interesting. I mean, that is a very interesting angle for someone who wants exposure to early exposure to treatments of this disease. I mean, there's really nothing out there right now. Remdesivir is the lead drug right now, and we need to make it.
Yeah, absolutely.
We need to be able to make it.
Yeah, so where is it? So remdesivir at the moment, and it had emergency FDA approval. So where are it at the moment with it? Do you know, or what?
So it has emergency use approval. Gilead, obviously, you know, they're doing other studies, but they've already donated, I think, 1.5 million doses to the U.S. government. But look, so there's a desire to make this drug. You know, it's shown. I think from what I remember on the data, it has reduced the hospitalization period from 15 days down to 11 in the early results. There's much bigger trials going on with it, so we'll get more clarity in time. But it clearly was good enough data to get emergency use approval. You know what I mean? Which you can't say the same for other drugs that are being trialed, you know quickly as well. Like... you know, like the malarial drug, right? The anti-malarial, you know, which didn't get approval.
Yeah, well, do you know what? It's very interesting. I'm just reading an article on CNN here. They say at the moment there's only enough remdesivir in the world for about 100,000 to 200,000 patients, according to the drugs maker Gilead, and they are looking to manufacture more. So there we go. You can see there.
Well, there you go. How tight it is. Exactly. I read that Gilead was... Maybe they have promised to produce 1.5 million as a donation.
I just saw that somewhere. Very interesting. Okay, so that's
I mean, it is a genuine challenge. Similar to like Novacyte, you know, again, the demand will be there. The drug we know now has been approved in one jurisdiction, an important one, the U.S. So it needs to be made now.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so that is Bemexico at BXP is the ticker there. 42.5 pence, about 172 million market cap. Worth doing some research on because, like I said, a very hot area. And do you know what? The chart has been pretty much in a downtrend from 2017. It was at 69 pence. It's now at 42 pence. It's not been a scary downtrend, but it's had a bounce recently. It went down about 32 pence up to 42 pence. And who knows? This may be the bottom here, because of course if you've got extra demand, then and it'll get on the radar with people as if they're producing this drug, won't it? I suppose, you know.
I mean, I think that's an important thing. Exactly, is that, you know, I think now they're getting on the radar. That's why you're seeing a bit of a rally. You know, it's a solid company. You know, I suspect in the grand scheme of things, you know, there is always the COVID problem globally for, you know, marketing, distribution, sourcing product. All of these issues impact every business. We still haven't, you know, we still haven't been fully figured out what the impact is on all these businesses. But here, this business has one angle that's a very important one, and it's a good business. You know what I mean? Regardless of whatever short-term turbulence the market is, you know, the global pharmaceutical. Because we're talking about all the other products, right? Mm-hmm. Right? Global pharmaceutical market faces. In the long term, all those products have a pretty inelastic, market, because there's a genuine need for them. This company has been growing historically very, very strongly. You know, it's seen double digit growth on a sustained basis, top line double digit growth, for as long as I've known them for years and years and years. And now they're stepping into an area that is you know, of high demand immediately, and they have the capability to make the drug.
Marvelous stuff.
So, you know, one that's overlooked and worth it. You're right, worth looking into.
Excellent stuff, Vadim. Thanks for uncovering that. And you mentioned them about a year back, I think. But I said then, oh, good financials there, good fundamentals. But now they've got this added string to their bow. It's going to help them even more. That's BXP, Beximco Pharmaceuticals. And Vadim, thanks for that. And we'll speak to you next week.
Excellent. Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
Joining me right now is Glenn, the good man, fighting the good cause against the Bitcoin cryptocurrency war. I don't know if that's the case, but he's written a book. It's called The Crypto Trader. And Bitcoin, hey, woo, Bitcoin, woo, it's been very exciting, Bitcoin, isn't it?
It has. It's been a roller coaster
it's
of
gone
a
up
week, Justin.
And down.
Up and down. Down and up.
Has it halved? Is the halving happening?
It has. The big halving has, or halvening,
as
they call it.
Trouble is, with social distancing, I didn't make the halving festival. I didn't make that. Didn't make it because, was that cancelled, the halving festival?
Yeah, we all danced around a virtual maypole in order to celebrate the great halving of 2020. Yeah. So for people who don't know what we're talking about, the halving or halvening is an event that happens only once every 4 years in the world of Bitcoin, and it's when the Bitcoin rewards to the Bitcoin miners are halved. And what that means is that the supply of new Bitcoin that emerges from the miners' mines every day is half as large as it was before. So supply is being slowly choked off. It's now down to really a trickle of new Bitcoin. And of course, anybody who worships Bitcoin, and there are many of these people, they love this because it shows the world once again that Bitcoin is a hard currency, one that cannot be printed in endless amounts, and in fact is only being printed now in absolutely tiny amounts relative to its total supply. And so therefore, they say, in a world where money is being printed endlessly, people will inevitably turn to Bitcoin and to gold and as their only kind of salvation, as hard currencies. We've talked about this a lot in previous weeks, but I wanted to put a theory to you that it's kind of devil's advocate, really, because
you're the advocate again. I want the devil. Get the devil in. I don't want his advocate. Is he busy? He's busy, is he, I suppose?
He's always busy. He's got a lot of nasty stuff to be doing. Yeah, so I'm going to be his advocate today.
Okay.
And what I would say about this, there is an alternative.
Can I just say, when you sit down with the devil of the morning, does he give you the stuff to do? You know, like, today I want to do act as my advocate for Bitcoin.
Yeah,
I'll be spreading coronavirus. You act as my advocate and just talk about Bitcoin. Go on then.
So what's there's a number of windows in it which have to be filled in his evil schedule. And I'm glad to fill one of those windows today by telling you that there is an alternative, an opposite, if you will, to the theory that Bitcoin simply has to rocket and gold has to rocket because of the endless money printing. The way that traditional theory goes, and of course it's very, very popular right now, is that when you're printing money endlessly, it inevitably causes inflation, not necessarily even consumer price inflation. As we saw after 2008 financial crash, we didn't get consumer price inflation in large quantities from all the money printing that was going on, but instead asset prices like stocks and houses in many parts of the world were going up and up for years. So that's the idea, is that that's where the excess money kind of ended up, right? And so that is, in a sense, inflation. But when you have inflation like that, that is sort of very, very, that has been pushed up by money printing, then what you tend to get is negative real interest rates. This is where it starts to get a bit complicated, but bear with me because it's important. It's important. Negative real interest rates, because if interest rates are artificially held very low, as they have been for the past decade by all the central banks, holding interest rates very low, but you've got inflation running a few percent ahead of interest rates, then that means that the real interest rate, i.e. the interest rate after you've accounted for inflation, is actually a negative interest rate, right? And when negative, when real interest rates are negative, this means that people aren't earning a real return on their savings if they have them in savings accounts. Therefore, they seek out other assets that might give them a return, like stocks, for example. But it also means that they're more likely to put their money into hard currencies like gold and possibly Bitcoin, because they're not put off by the fact that gold doesn't provide you any interest, because of the fact is they're earning a negative real interest rate in their savings accounts anyway, so they don't mind putting their money in gold. Now, what could be happening this time is deflation, right? You've probably heard a lot of people talking about how the economy is doing so badly that, in fact, nominal prices, not just in the shops, but also prices of other assets, might decrease over time, you know, a Great Depression type scenario. Now, the problem there is that because interest rates are stuck at more or less zero, if inflation goes into reverse and we get deflation, like minus 3%, say minus 4%, then what you'll end up with is a real rate of interest that is very high, like maybe a 4% rate of real interest, for example. And what that will tend to do is the opposite. It will tend to discourage people from investing in gold because gold doesn't provide an interest rate, whereas these people could then be earning a real interest rate of 4% just in their normal savings accounts. So they might be discouraged from gold, and for the same reason they might be discouraged from
Bitcoin. I don't know if you saw it from CNBC. I tweeted it about the Deputy Governor of Bank of England saying negative interest rates are a possibility. So it's very relevant at the moment. But it's because of the, like you say, deflationary system. And this happens, of course, because people get very scared and they start hoarding money. And they stop spending because they're worried about their job. They're worried about they have a future. So they're only spending on big ticket items like fancy old washing machines or a new car or holidays. They don't do any of that because, listen, we may need this. So everyone stops spending. So of course, if you stop consuming, the producers don't have to produce as much. So they, we don't need all these people, helping us in the factory. We're not selling as much. So they lay those people off. Everyone starts getting worried. The prices start going down, and of course, and that can, and people say, "Oh, the prices are going down on everything. Why buy now when in 6 months' time it could be even cheaper?" So you're saying if the prices of goods go down and you're holding money in a bank, then that money essentially is appreciating in value because you can buy more stuff with it. So is that what you're saying?
Exactly what I'm saying. And so that therefore encourages people with a lot of savings to just go, "Oh, I'll leave my money in the bank then," because even though the nominal interest rate is zero or close to zero, the real interest rate, the idea is that people are clever enough. I don't know if this, this is economic theory, so it's anybody's guess how much this actually happens in real life, that people actually are clever enough to put two and two together and go, okay, even though the nominal interest rate rate on my savings is 0%. Prices in the shops are going down. Prices everywhere are going down. And therefore, it's actually good value for me to keep my money stable in a bank account earning 0%.
Yeah, so I can, at the moment, they said last year I could have bought a nice fancy pair of shoes. And now that pair of shoes, I can buy a pair of shoes and a half. If I wait 6 months, I'll be able to buy two pairs of shoes with the same amount of money.
Exactly, so that's what the Japanese people have done to some degree, actually. So,
essentially,
so I'm saying it's anyone's guess, but there has been a real-world experiment. Japan, over the past 20 years,
and Europe,
a lot of the time they have that situation.
Sweden as well,
that's true, parts of Europe. It does encourage people to keep their money in the bank, it seems, from a few experiments. But obviously the problem is it differs from country to country. This is why economic theory is so dodgy in general. And I've studied it a lot. Well, I studied it at university, and I've studied it a lot since, economics. And the big problem with it is that the theory, you know, you'll get some countries where what we predict, what we've just predicted, will indeed happen, like Japan. But then there are other countries where the complete opposite thing happens. And so it's very difficult to conduct real world experiments where you get a consistent conclusion for a question like that.
Yeah, because the thing is that they're saying also about separating out central banks and domestic accounts, because they're saying the problem is they don't want central banks parking their money. They don't want banks and institutions parking their money with central banks overnight and hoarding it there. They want them sort of investing it. So that's why they may charge, you know, institutions and all that stuff a negative interest rate to hold their money overnight and all that stuff. But when it comes to domestic people, then I think there'd be a bit of an uproar. If, you know, well, people won't be happy with it whilst they do that. I mean, people may just take it out of the bank and keep it in their mattress. But I mean, they you know, if you put, well, like £1,000, for example, in an account, and they're going to charge you minus 2% for that, or say 100, let's say, we can find round figures, now it's easy for percentages, put £100 in a bank account, it's a minus 2% interest, then they'll, end of that year, you'll have 98 quid. Now, so that's discouraging you from saving it. They want you to spend it. But people will just take it out of a bank, shouldn't they? Just hold it that way. If they know the economy's that bad, they'll say, well, fair enough, I won't put it in the bank. I'll just keep it under my mattress or whatever. Or buy Bitcoin.
Which is why many economists and central bankers are so keen to abolish cash altogether and to bring in digital currencies, central bank digital currencies, in order to replace cash and that way they can effectively stop people altogether from doing that, taking money out of the bank because there are negative interest rates and hiding it under their mattress. So it's a tool. Abolishing cash would be a great tool for central banks to achieve utter control, complete control over populations, and to effectively take people's money from them by forcing them to keep it in a bank because, you know, in this hypothetical, not so hypothetical world, cash, notes and coins don't actually exist in this near future world, and therefore you are forced to keep your money in a bank account where it earns minus 2% interest. So 2% of your money is taken away from you each year. That is, it sounds like a dystopia, but it's very realistic.
I know, but the thing is, it just makes you realise, even the talk of this, how worried the Bank of England are about the economy. You know, if they're seriously, and they're thinking that, you know, that we could have a depression on our hands and we could have deflation. And that's exactly what they want to avoid. That will really shove the economy into not only neutral, but reverse pretty much. And they hugely want to, and so they're going, taking these unprecedented steps to do that. And so that really worries me. And it's that knock of confidence that I think at the moment the markets are quite disjointed from the real economy because we've had stimulus, you've had the fear of missing out on this rally and all that stuff. And yet, you know, I drew a chart a month back to say this is how I see it going. I see this euphoria over deaths coming down, unlocking the economy, but that's when the financial fallout will happen, and then when we have more stimulus. But you can't stimulate, you know, if a lot of people are unemployed. You know, it's like you can't just ask people to buy stuff if they're scared to buy, because most people don't have a month's worth of savings, you know.
If you've got a ton of unemployed people, the sensible thing for governments to do, and which they're now obviously turning to more and more, is fiscal policy or a kind of monetary policy where you just print money and give it directly to people, you know, so-called helicopter money, that kind of thing. In order to, so either you give people money or well, you could do a number of different things. Obviously, you can give people money directly, which will encourage them to hopefully at least spend some of it and not save all of it. But also, you invest massively in infrastructure. You use fiscal policy to start massive government programs. Yeah, I mean, I know that's a scary thing. Massive government programs often don't end up with the best results. But in the case of emergency, when you've got massive unemployment, like say you have in America at the moment, then starting huge government infrastructure programs, you know, fixing all those terrible motorways, highways that they have in America that have been neglected for so many years, you know, a massive building program for those, employ tons and tons of people to fix up the motorways. The government pays for the whole thing, gets itself in even bigger debt, of course. But in case of emergency, that's most economists consider that a sensible thing to do.
Yeah. I just wonder, how do you avoid... Yeah, do you know what? Is it a case of just like... how would the government say, listen, what we're going to do is we're going to invest on your behalf. Every one of you, £1,000 each or something.
Yeah.
Invest in something. Well, I don't understand why... In fact, why don't governments... You know, like, I understand in America, they're saying don't go into high-risk yields or corporate bonds and all this stuff. But when you think of it, it's an investment, you know, and the government gets its money back. So they're doing that, at least that way they're not... Like, at the moment, I understand that all these furlough schemes, they're not going to get their money back ever. So that's it's a couple of trillion down the drain. And it's not down the drain because it's supporting the economy, of course, and people's livelihoods and all that stuff. But, you know, they could... you know, backstop a lot of companies and just borrow a tiny interest rate or small interest rates because compared to where we are at the moment, just buying this corporate debt, at least they'd get a bit of money back, wouldn't they? I don't know.
Well, you know, look, the American government is pulling out all the stops. They're the most sort of extreme of all the world governments in terms of spending, because President Trump, I mean, there are kind of grumbling voices within the Republican Party who've been complaining to the president, so I've been reading, saying, you know, this is getting ridiculous now, we're building up massive debts. But, you know, Trump doesn't really care. He's not a proper Republican. He's
not
a hard
debt.
Fiscal...
Trump doesn't give a debt. He's gone through so many times.
He doesn't care about fiscal probity fiscal...
No, but let's be honest. You know. I mean, he's gone into administration about 10 times. He doesn't care. It's never been his fault, apparently. He doesn't care about debt. He doesn't worry about that at all.
He's a big fan of debt.
If he can get hold of money, he doesn't care whose it is, to pay it back. Don't worry about that.
But just to kind of wrap up what I was saying before, so that people listening understand the message I'm trying to give here. What I'm saying is, you know, you've all probably, including me, been reading a lot of stuff about how the price of gold is inevitably going to go up because of all the money printing that's going on, and so therefore gold and Bitcoin are hard currencies and they will inevitably go up. And so what I'm saying is that may be the case, but you need to keep a very close eye on real interest rates. Real interest rates are the key to understanding what the price of gold does most of the time. If you look back historically at the correlation, you can see there's a very clear correlation between real interest rates and what happens to the price of gold. So you just need to check. And of course, real interest rates, as we've said, are very heavily influenced, not just by the level of nominal interest rates, but by the level of inflation. So you need to keep an eye on what inflation's doing, keep an eye on what nominal interest rates are doing, and then you can work out, or just Google, what's the real interest rate? That's probably the quickest way. And then you can find out. And if real interest rates are negative, then you know that gold is not necessarily such a fantastic investment, whereas if the real interest rate is positive, then the... Hold on, have I got that the wrong way around? I've got that the wrong way around.
It's an easy one. Just get a chart. look at the chart, see if it's at a year low, then buy some gold. That's it.
Yeah. Just try for it. See, find a chart which shows the correlation, then you get an idea of where the price of gold might be heading. That's the point.
Don't worry about correlation. Just look back at the chart and think, is gold at a one-year low? If it is, buy a little bit. And every time that happens, it touches, say, a 12-month low, buy a little bit. And that's all you need to do. That's all.
So
you
you're just saying dollar cost average into gold forever.
Pretty much. And look how well you'd have done. It done very well. Same with Bitcoin. You know, every time Bitcoin's over 12 months.
I don't know.
Every time Bitcoin it's 12 months low, buy a bit.
Yeah, but if you look at, I mean, gold, this is a very interesting one because I was arguing
gold
about
this. Gold has outperformed the S&P. Gold has done very well.
Recently, but look, I was arguing with a guy, a Bitcoin researcher.
Yeah, we live in recent times.
And basically I was saying, yeah, but the point is, he was saying, because this is the other big story of the week that I haven't mentioned yet, and this is a good segue into it, which is Paul Tudor Jones. You know Paul Tudor Jones? He's a kind of a legendary trader.
Yeah, I know him, yeah.
Right. And he basically said...
I saw him yesterday, yeah, on the CNBC, yeah.
That's right. Yeah, he was on CNBC yesterday, and he's been talking up Bitcoin, and so it's got a lot of people very excited because if Paul Tudor Jones, who's an investment guru and a real tried and tested and proven legend, if he's saying that Bitcoin has a place in his portfolio, albeit a very small place, just 1 or 2% maybe of his portfolio, if he's saying that, then that will encourage a lot of other institutions to take it more seriously because the so-called reputation risk will be gone. In other words, junior fund managers can say to their bosses, I'm going to put a bit of our fund into Bitcoin. Is that okay? Because Paul Tudor Jones does it, so it must be all right. And his bosses will go, yeah, I guess. If Paul Tudor Jones is doing it, then it must be okay. So it takes away that career risk for the junior asset managers and hopefully would provide a long-term boost to the price of Bitcoin as a result.
Yeah. But That's like saying, listen, I've gone big in the airlines because Buffett has. And then all of a sudden, you realise that Buffett sold a load of it and he took a $50 million loss on it. All right, listen, that didn't work out. No, I understand.
He did say
1% maybe, didn't he, of his portfolio's got in Bitcoin, which is fine.
Not a great deal, but the point I wanted to make...
I understand. For him, let me say one other thing. And for him, 1% is probably a lot of money.
So
it's still a lot of money. Now for the average Joe, 1% of their portfolio isn't meaningful enough to do anything to your portfolio. No, so talking in percent, because I've been doing this work at percentages wise, and I've done it for my portfolio. Then a mate of mine said, "Well, who's got a bit less than me?" And said, "Well, that's not good enough for me because having those small percentage amounts wouldn't help." I said, "Okay, so it's maybe."
Clearly he thinks Bitcoin is still super risky, or he wouldn't be talking about just putting 1% into it.
Let's be honest, his 1% is probably a lot of money, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm sure it's an enormous amount of money, but it's still only 1% for him, so it's still a small thing as far as he's concerned. It's obviously, as I say, it must be a big risk. If he really thought Bitcoin was a dead cert for the future, like he's kind of talking about, then he'd be putting more than 1% of his portfolio into it. I don't know, but anyway, my point was about him. Well, one interesting thing he said was that because I read his entire briefing note that he wrote, and he said that it reminds him now of 1970. In 1976, gold was becoming more. They were inventing derivatives that allowed easier to trade gold than it had been previously. Lots of clever ways for financial people to trade gold. So suddenly, in the 70s, when he first started trading, loads of people started taking an interest in gold, and that all fueled the big gold rally, which culminated in a huge climax around about 1980. There was a massive spike in the price of gold, and he's sort of saying now is the same with Bitcoin. It reminds him of it. And so he feels like, now interest is building in Bitcoin and institutions are going to get in. And, he's implying there may be a huge price spike like there was in gold. And I was arguing about this with a Bitcoin researcher because I was basically saying, yeah, that's all well and good. But I kind of hope that this isn't like 1976 for Bitcoin, because if you look at what happened to the price of gold after 1976, you've got this huge spike up to 1980. But then the price fell slowly but steadily for 20 years. 20 years. Right, that's so we talk about gold
I don't believe that
appreciates, but it fell for 20 years.
But the market's a lot faster, a lot more liquid these days, isn't it? More investors are involved in. By the way, Paul Tudor Jones' net worth is $5.1 billion, and I'm assuming that's not all is in stocks and stuff. You've got other assets, but so 51. If he did put 1% in, it'd be $51 million worth. So even if you divide that by 10, it's so he's got $5 million. He's got over probably $1 million worth in Bitcoin. So I assume. So 1% is quite a bit. But I think the market's a lot faster, a lot more liquid than they are in the 70s. We did the internet even, completely just changed the landscape. Like I remember even when I first started, I had to call up Barclays and get a price and get all. And now I hate that. I would never do that. I never do that if the internet goes down, you know. But it's so quick now. Just log on, do it straight away. It's fun. And Bitcoin is so easy to buy these days, unlike gold was in the 70s, you know. So it's a bit different now, isn't it? So I don't think you'll ever see Bitcoin go for a 20-year dip. It'll probably literally be, you know, mass. I think that one we had 18 months worth is probably the longest we'll ever see again now, I think, you know.
But I hope you're right, because being a guy who's written a book called The Crypto Trader, it would be quite boring for me.
If
the price of cryptos fell for 20 years before then going. Because, of course, the thing about gold
is
that
then when the internet is transformed, do you think? Do the internet has transformed the investment?
The speed of movements of prices. Well, put it this way: the crypto markets are the fastest. Yeah, I mean, you're quite right. They're the fastest moving markets we've ever yet seen. You know, the booms and busts are so much bigger than any other asset, and they happen more quickly. So that's been the experience so far in the past decade. And as you say, maybe it's just to do with the ease of trading, the fact that in the 1970s and 80s gold moved more slowly because, all right, you had the people in the pits shouting and all the rest of it to do the trading, but the ordinary people and the pension funds and so on were just moving a lot more slowly because it was that much more difficult to trade. As you say, you'd have to, you know, there are a lot more steps in the process. You'd phone your broker, you'd have a long discussion about it with your broker, and they'd contact the jobber or the guy in the pit.
All right, we don't need it all. We're just saying less accessible.
All right, but I'm just saying, you know, there are a lot more steps on the way. Whereas, yeah, nowadays, as you say, it's amazingly easy. You just turn on your app and you're trading in seconds, you know, in and out, in and out.
People know this. People know this. You're giving people details on what they know. We know this, don't we?
They don't all know that. There's probably at least one person.
So what I do is I log on. I log on. I put in my password and then I check my app. It gives me extra password. I log in there. I search for the company I'm looking for. I type in the ticker and I decide what's the amount of money at a time. We don't need to go through the steps, Glenn.
It's like Gavin and Stacey going, everything starts with a W, W, W. That's all you need to know.
I know. Anything else? You've got 3 minutes.
3 minutes. Oh, my Lord. Well, we haven't talked about the movements in the price of Bitcoin yet, so let's do a bit of that quickly. Because, as you said it's at the beginning, it's been a roller coaster this week. The price threatened to break out of a huge triangle.
Basically, $10,000 right on 10,000. It sort of pulled back, didn't it?
Wow. It did, right on the cusp of, well, not even just past the cusp of 10,000. It kind of like just poked its nose above the $10,000 mark and then went down again. And ever since then, it's been kind of hovering around the $8,500 level. You know, it's a tricky one. What's going to happen next? Because on one hand, yeah, it's bounced off a very important line that you can draw that kind of shows we've been in a bear market since beginning of 2018. And you can draw this lovely triangle that goes all the way down from the top of the peak of the boom at 2018, all the way down to where we are now. And all the prices in between fit within that triangle. So Bitcoin was just threatening to burst out of that triangle, which from a chartist's perspective would be a very, very positive sign, because when all the prices keep moving within one trading range for a very long time and then the price bursts out of that trading range, that's usually a very bullish indicator, because it's all the people's trading plans go out the window. Everybody who is planning to trade within that range has to tear up their plans and rewrite everything, and in the meantime prices tend to rocket. That's how chartists like me often make our money from breakouts like that. But here's the thing, it bounced off and it went back down. So we're back within that trading range now. And a lot of people are thinking, well, surely we're now just going to fall all the way back down to the bottom of that trading range now, which would be, what, about $5,000 from the $8,500 that we're at now? In fact, $4,500 would be the bottom of that trading range. I'm not 100% convinced yet, because the price, it did fall, it bounced, but it didn't bounce very strongly. You know, if you look at the chart now, you can see it bounced down, But it stopped, as I say, at about 8,500, and it's just been kind of mooching around there for quite some time. Whereas usually when you get a strong bounce off the top, it tends to kind of fall quite heavily, quite quickly. We haven't had that yet. It's very much in an in-between stage. It's trying to decide, all the traders are trying to decide, what are we doing next? Are we going to have another bash at that 10,000 level, or are we going to head all the way back down to the bottom of the trading range? It's in the balance at the moment, which is why I am once again out of Bitcoin. I made a bit of profit on the rise, and then I sold because I could see it was not, you know, it was not roaring out above that 10,000 level. It wasn't doing what I hoped it would do. So I took my profit and got out.
Glenn, here's a fail safe right trading strategy on Bitcoin.
Yeah.
On a daily chart, wait for it goes under 30, right, and then wait for a rebound back. Once it touches above 40 from under 30, so it's going upwards, buy. And every time that happens, you make money.
Hold on, 30 what? 30?
RSI on the 30. So it goes,
oh,
so
the RSI.
Below
right.
30, so it goes below 30, yeah. So coming down, don't touch it, it starts rising back up, then it goes above 30 again, then it breaks through 40 in the RSI, bite then, onto a winner every time.
Well, all right, I'm gonna start charting the RSI right. Well, I mean, I do use it sometimes anyway, but I'm gonna stick it on my chart right now after our little conversation I'm going to study that.
If you've done that, you're a bought, and normally big up days actually bought. You're a bought on around about 6,500, 6,62 the last rally, and all the way up then. And wait, then until it goes to 70. Once it goes back down to sell, it was oversold. Let's say it's oversold again, then sell. That's it.
Okay, RSI 30 and RSI 40. Right, I'm going to plot that now.
Basically, wait, 30, and then it'll.
Yeah, I can see the 30 line. You're right, it always bounces off the 30 line. Except when it doesn't. What about the times when it doesn't, though?
I mean, when it goes below this, it has to go below 30. Right, yeah. Then it has to come back above 30 and back past 40. So literally, you're buying on 41 or 40 point something. So as long as you know the momentum is in the right direction, but it has to be oversold first, and then wait.
So you're buying on 40 and you're selling on 30. Did you say?
No. Listen, I'm over time. There are guests waiting, and there's a sidelines here. Don't touch it. Don't touch it until it goes below 30. Don't touch it still. Then just watch. So you'll be pinged right below 30. Right.
Yes.
Wait now. Then reset the alert until it goes above. So crossing above 30. Then it has to cross above 30 because it goes up. Yeah. So it's going back up. Then it has to cross above 40. Then buy as soon as it crosses 40. Right. Then hold. Then just hold until it goes above 70, alert, then it comes back down. As soon as it comes back down over 70, sell there. Okay.
I'm going to try and I'm going to do that.
I'm going to start there, but it may be ages until it's oversold.
I'm going to do a back test on that by this time next week. When I speak to you next week, I hope to be able
just
to
say it works. Right.
I'm going to algorithmatize your strategy, and then I'll be able to say, well done, you've made that much money.
I don't want you testing my back anytime. All right, lovely.
I love it.
Glasgow, speak to you next week.
Okay,
it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They're at five, Mosman Oil and Gas, up 19% to 0.185 MSMN, ticker there. At four, Vodafone Group, up 5% to 119. In fact, just jumped there, up 8% to 122. Wow. At three, Velocis, VLS, up 10% to 2.78. At two, Omega Diagnostics, down 6.5% to 50.5. And at one, Hemogenix Pharmaceuticals. It's up 4.28 at 9.75 pence. All right. Top five most liked RSEs are as follows. At five, Fast Forward Innovations, Investee Company Update, Portage Biotechs. At four, Beta Player Metallurgical Test Work by Vast. Avacta ships SARS-CoV-2 Afirma reagents to Sativa and Adeptrix. That's a three. At two, updated mine plan. Materially increases production. That's Armadale Capital. And at one, it is... Who is it? Incondesi Energy. General update. Having said that, most read it down 5.2. 2% to 3.65 pence. NCCL sticker there. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Much appreciate it.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5 quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.